Hello, this is your host Narina, and welcome to The Startup Way, a podcast where we unveil stories behind the scenes of startups' glorious success and drastic failure, spark thought-provoking conversations with investors, and engage leading experts to reveal what the future of technology beholds. The podcast series are powered by SSS Venture Capital Firm, here to help you start, scale, and succeed in the startup world.
Hi, today I have the pleasure of hosting Harry Glorican, who is an executive leader with extensive experience in life sciences and healthcare. He's also a general partner at Scientia Ventures VC firm. Harry, thank you for joining our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you please tell us about how you started your venture capital journey? Did you have prior biotech, health tech experience?
Yes. So my background, I worked in the industry of healthcare and life sciences for, I would say, almost 25 years in multiple companies. And then after I sold my last company, I started working with GE Ventures as an entrepreneur in residence. And I was... It was a very unique group. We were actually coming up with our own ideas of what was needed in the market and doing the work. And then the best ideas we would fund, spin up, and hire teams and get them going. And then a gentleman that I've known for a long time that I've sat on a number of boards with called me up and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm spinning up companies from scratch." And he said, "We're about to do our third fund. Why don't you come and join as a general partner?" And that was my sort of official entree into a formal venture fund.
So across its three funds, Scientia Ventures made investments in 31 companies, if I'm correct, out of which five already had an IPO. In the world of high-risk investments, that is deemed as decent exit rates. How do you approach evaluating investment opportunities, and what are the key indicators that signal a startup's potential future success to you?
So, I mean, besides liking the concept, you know, the technology space, understanding the dynamics there, which, you know, hopefully we're coming to the table with that knowledge from our experiences. It really comes down to team. Can this team get done what they're trying to get done? Do they have the right individuals? Do they have the right experience, or do they have the right attitude? And you know, once you get going, it's almost like, I don't want to say being married, but it's not completely different. It truly is a partnership where you're trying to work with a company and doing what you can to help them be successful. And so you have to have the right team members there that will do what needs to be done and then are also open to potentially learning as they go along. If someone is too confident in every little aspect and is not open to learning, that's a red flag.
Definitely. I would so agree with you on that one. So out of these five IPOs, which was the most notable IPO for you specifically? And what do you think were the main factors that contributed to the startup's success?
Well, I don't know if I would call Royalty Pharma a startup anymore, but that was probably the one I knew the most about, which was, you know, they were the largest pharmaceutical royalty fund in the world, and they still are. I had been told about them when I first met my partner, and I think back then they were generating, I believe it was, you know, $600 or $700 million a year in revenue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they with 92-93% margins, So you can do the math. That was just ridiculous numbers. Yes. I think we were walking down the street and he was telling me, and I think I stopped walking because I was like, I don't think I'm doing the math right. And then he goes, no, you're doing the math right. And I'm like, oh my God. Okay. But you know, watching that go through its different movements, you know, because it produced so much cash flow, is, you know, how do they get the existing investors to go to a liquidity event, and what needs to happen and how to structure it? And it was an offshore entity, and there was a lot of interesting moves along the way that I got to watch. You know, two of my other partners were much more intimately involved in that company. But then watching it go public was quite interesting. And I still hold all my stock today that I still have in the company, because I believe, you know, with that sort of a revenue engine, over time, it'll perform.
I see. So thinking about investing in biotech in general, how is it different from investing in other sectors? What are the nuances to consider?
Well, you know, it's funny because when you say investing in biotech, right? You know, to me, investing has always meant that there's a P&L to evaluate. And there's no such thing in biotech, right? You almost have to think about it as, yeah, you're investing, but in some ways you're gambling that the science is going to work, right? And science doesn't always do what you want it to do. But that's why I tell you, like, the team is so important, right? Because you've got to figure out how to make the science work. You've got to structure the experiments to do what you want them to do and to get the outcome that you want it to go. You have to have the team that understands how they're going to get it through regulatory. And then ultimately, you know, when they get to the end, how they're going to get it reimbursed and therefore how they're going to commercialize it. But I have never seen, or it's been an incredibly rare occasion where things move in a straight line. It's always, you know, ups and downs and heartache and, oh my God, are we going to run out of money? And do we need to go raise more money? And I mean, you know, this phenomenon of, you know, $50 million, $100 million Series A, I mean, those are just ridiculous numbers. You know, it's usually the one where you're, you know, you raise 15 or 20 million and then, are we going to get to the results we need to get to? And then, oh, we're going to raise another, you know, 20 or 30 million because we need to do that, you know, phase one trial. And then, you know, it's this constant battle, to do the right work and then move that ball forward while you're trying to keep everybody motivated and moving in the same direction. And so it's funny because I've seen people who have no experience with the process get too close to it. And you can see them almost like start to lose their hair because they're just not familiar with it. You know, it's like going whitewater rafting, and your first whitewater rafting, you go, you know, in the most turbulent river that you can find, and your experience is, you're very shaken after the experience. I think, you know, anybody that's investing or working in this space has to understand that the ups and downs are quite dramatic. And COVID is a great example because it interrupted a lot of clinical trials. And then you had to help all those companies survive until, you know, we could get patients back in the door.
So with biotech investment, the other thing you keep in mind is ethics, different ethical considerations. So how do you pay attention to ethical considerations when considering different biotech, health tech investment opportunities.
What do you mean by when you say ethic goal? You mean managing the finances ethically? Do you mean, you know, patients and your ethical obligation to
ethical
that population?
Patients, different societal implications of the technology.
So, you know, I think for the most part, at least all the drugs that I've had an exposure to, you know, there's a clear benefit that you're making in a disease where, you know, those big major issues, you know, probably don't come into play because you can see a clear, you know, you're going to actually help these people. And there's, you know, pretty much one straightforward use to the therapeutic that you're working on. But if you're working on something like CRISPR or your gene editing or, you know, the implications there are much broader. And I think that, you know, in those situations, you have to really sit back and think about what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do or what you want to do and make sure that everybody stays on the same path. I mean, we've invested in a company that is making edits to crops to have the crops have unique traits that make them, let's say, more resilient to heat or drought or salt or different conditions like that. And actually, the way that we do it, you wouldn't be able to tell whether it just happened naturally by itself or whether, you know, we actually made the change itself. That's how subtle the change is that we're able to make in the crops that we're working on. And so you have to work with the regulators, understand their concerns, you know, put in the right guidelines in the organization so that you can achieve your goal of producing a product that's going to make a difference to society, but at the same time, not, you know, break the rules or do something that would cause everybody to have a heart attack. But I would say that there's a number of technologies now that are available that, you know, in different people getting their hands on it or making decisions, it sort of makes you step back and wonder what's going to happen in the future.
So how do you approach tracking innovation to make sure you're up to date with recent research and development in the biotech and health tech subsectors of interest to the fund?
So not sleep much, but, you know, read as much as I possibly can. You know, conferences are another opportunity to stay abreast of new things that are happening. You know, obviously the connections of people that I'm speaking to, reading is probably at the foremost, mm-hmm. At the top of the list. You know, although, you know, we have worked on an AI system that helps us understand which technologies are moving forward and can help us forecast where to at least focus our efforts. Because if you think there's a million new papers a year, mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's impossible for a human being to keep up with that sort of pace.
Talking about AI and using AI in the venture capital world, I mean, venture capitalists are the evangelists of innovation, seeking and advancing disruption across industries. However, if you think about it, venture capital itself is one of the industries where operations are still run in a very traditional low-tech way. And like over the years, various tools have been emerging for venture capitalists. And a specifically interesting category in the VC tools landscape are solutions that unlock the power of data. So leveraging analytics and AI to dramatically increase the deal flow and help with due diligence. Apart from the tool that you mentioned, are there any other data and AI tools that you use in your VC day-to-day life? And what have been the benefits that you were able to observe from their implementation?
Well, I mean, if you're thinking about, you know, data-driven venture funds, I think the last number that I saw, I think 1% of venture funds in the world are, or maybe 2%, I don't know, 1 to 2% are truly data-driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, it's funny. It's one of those things of, you know, that saying of, do as I say, not as I do. Like, you be innovative and implement all these things, but you know, I'll eventually get there, sort of thing. You know, people think if it's not broke, don't fix it, sort of thing. So, you know, I think the venture industry has an extremely long way to go to sort of put their money where their mouth is. There are some funds that utilize AI and analytics in, I would say, in certain parts of decision making. I think others will use it on their back end, sort of LP management, you know, file access, you know, accounting management. Some will, you know, obviously use a CRM or some sort of platform that allows them to identify deal flow. But these are all the different areas that, or maybe on their due diligence side and managing their portfolio on the back end. But it's, yeah, I don't know of any firm that sort of has a full stack across the entire workflow. They're almost like using different technologies along the way. And if you went into a firm, I don't even know if unless it's a larger firm, maybe there's some uniformity of everybody using the same platforms.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that there's a long way to go in this industry. And I do believe that by putting our money where our mouth is, you actually give the partners and the staff more time to spend with the company as opposed to wasting time pushing paper or trying to find something, or, you know, your LP calls and you're scrambling to sort of get them what they need.
But what do you think is the reason why venture capital industry is in general so resistant to change?
I mean, some of it, you know, it's just, you know, I'm reflecting on my experience of humans unwilling to change over time is usually just, you know, it's working. What I'm doing is working. And so why adopt that change? Some people will say, well, I'm really busy doing what I'm doing, right? And implementing change, you have to put the time and effort into it. You know, these systems don't just drop from the sky and, you know, when you push a button, it works overnight. Like, you've got to work it into your workflow and train everybody. And, you know, even when you have these systems, because I've seen it with, you know, people I interact with, is you put a system in place, that doesn't mean they use it. You know, people will always go back to their old habits. So you've got to put the right systems in place that sort of, I don't want to say force, but encourage people to adopt the new paradigm. And then some people, you know, they'll always question, like, well, when am I going to see the payback on that? And, you know, all these systems that I'm talking about don't necessarily pay back on day one, right? It's like any investment. It takes some time to reap the benefit of something that you put in place. So I think all of those are impediments to having people adopt this. And then I think some of it is just hubris, right? Like, we really know what we're doing. We're very good at this. We've been very good at this. You know, I don't want to change what we've always done.
Going back to biotech and health tech, can you mention some of the most recent trends in the biotech health tech sectors that are particularly exciting for you?
Oh, I don't know if we have that much time on the show, but
and just a few, some of the most recent ones.
Well, I mean, you know, I wouldn't say they're, I guess time is relative, but, you know, recent would be, you know, different applications of AI to, you know, analyzing data, drug discovery and drug development, you know, using sensors and technologies in remote clinical trials, you know, utilizing data to create digital twins of patients so that you can, you know, test something out or even supplement a clinical trial. Let's see, what else? Gene editing, you know, is just, you know, fascinating about the, you know, the implications, but B, some of the diseases that we can now attack, immuno-oncology, and the, you know, what we're learning about how to implement it and make it more successful in the patients that we're giving it to. And then just the data analytics side of it, of, you know, the cost of sequencing going down, what we're able to do with patients, you know, these machine learning models that can look at a patient over time and actually predict what's going to happen to a person with every day, it seems like, increasing levels of accuracy. I mean, all of these areas where it's at the intersection of data and biology are areas that are of incredible interest to me, that I'm, you know, trying to keep up on and make investments as they come along with the right team and the right idea.
Can you mention some emerging biotech hubs where a lot of innovation is happening that investors should start paying attention to, hubs outside of the United States?
Considering I'm hyper-focused on the US and, you know, to a certain degree, Europe, I'm probably not versed enough on, let's say, Asia or some other places that have activity that would, you know, capture my attention. So if I said it, I might offend somebody in some geography because I'm leaving them out. You know, I would still say that, you know, the center of gravity is probably the US first. And even in the US, it's, you know, it's not, there's three places maybe. So it's, especially when you say biotech, I mean, what it takes to do biotech is, it's like, if you don't have all the right ingredients, it's really hard to make it all work. Like, you can only get so far, even if you have data and data analytics, you're sort of hampered when you don't have the rest of the ingredients to make the soup.
And what would that ingredients be? Can you list them?
Oh my God. I mean, it's, you know, having the right people that you can hire. So the, you know, that you've got to have the schools that have all the capabilities to train those individuals in the wet lab function, as well as on the informatics and technology side. You know, for example, I mean, just because you can identify something out of your, you know, fancy AI and machine learning platform, you got to take the next steps. You know, you've got to try it in a mouse model. And, you know, do you have the people in country, or do you need to outsource that to somewhere else? You know, when you're going to start a clinical trial, do you have all the right people that can help design it and start putting into play, right? Or do you have to outsource that? You know, it's does the geography have the things you need to do? And then eventually, where's your market? Is it in the geography you're in, or do you have to actually migrate the company to get funding and do everything else? You see, so it's there's a whole list of things that make a geography special that gives the company the opportunity to have real success, right? As opposed to a technology company that may, you know, you can basically put the app online and almost be geography agnostic to a certain degree. You still need certain things, but I don't think it's at the same level of complexity that exists for a biotech company.
You've been in the sector for such a long time already. What do you find most rewarding about working with biotech and health tech startups and helping them succeed?
Ultimately, it's, you know, if you get that drug out or that technology out, it really is like, you know, what did it do to those people that are benefiting from that? You know, the journey along the way is fun and, you know, incredibly aggravating sometimes, because, like I said, nothing moves in a straight line. But, you know, working with young startups, working with teams in a space that you can help them grow, that you can open doors, that you can work with them, you know, not just fund them, but help them get funding from other groups as they're moving along. And then the intellectual, you know, interaction of driving something forward is a lot of fun. You know, if it wasn't for the constant intellectual stimulation, I think I would be bored in this job. Because if it's just writing a check, it's completely uninteresting. So you need, I need all those other pieces so that I'm engaged and motivated.
Can you recall an example of a startup you initially passed on but later regretted not investing in?
I have missed out on three or four, mainly because we hadn't raised enough money yet, or we had basically deployed, you know, the majority of the fund and didn't have the dry powder to do the next one. And those are the ones that I regret the most, because I'm looking at a few of them and they're now probably a 5x uptick in valuation. And there's like four or five examples that we've had the opportunity to get up. There was one we walked away from because their cap table, safe note, and some of the, you know, financials they had, just we couldn't make them work. And the company has gone on to do quite well. I really wish we would have been more flexible to get into the deal. I really wanted to do it, but, you know, it happens. You know, you can't do every deal, unfortunately.
I think that no matter how much of an experienced investor you are, mistakes along the way are sometimes inevitable. And I wanted to learn about the lessons you've learned from your past investment failures or mistakes, and how have they influenced your investment approach? If there are any mistakes, of course.
No, there's always mistakes. I mean, there's always mistakes. You know, I guess, you know, trying to always keep an open mind, trying to listen as opposed to speak is something I've learned over time. You know, and when I mean listen, it's you're really not having a lot of active thought and opinion while you're listening to the person that you're talking to. Asking questions so that you can give them a chance to fill in the gaps, and that'll give you more of a sense of, you know, what they're doing and how they're doing it, and do they have an idea of what they're about to do next? And then trying not to tell anybody what to do, but trying to share an experience that you had somewhere else and what happened in that experience. I find that people are much more receptive to that as opposed to trying to tell them what to do. But, you know, it's constantly going back and thinking about, if something didn't go right, why didn't it go right? And is there something within at least my control that I could do to change that? And, you know, when you're in a partnership of of five other people. It's not always, everything is not in your control. But at least trying to manage the things that I have control over and see if I can do them better.
That was very insightful. I assume that being so actively involved with biotech and health tech, you inevitably learn a lot about health and wellness. Has this in any way impacted your lifestyle and the way you approach your own health? Can you bring some examples?
Oh, yeah. You know, my kids, I think at one point were making fun of me because I had like, I don't know, six or seven devices hanging off my body. So, you know, because you can't talk about the space, understand the space if you're not playing with you know, different things or trying different things. And so I've tried to, you know, work on things like my sleep. You know, I can't, you know, I've been drinking less and less and less. I mean, I would say a lot less than I ever have in the past, right? Just because I've noticed what it does to my sleep. Prioritize exercise, getting up at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning and going to the gym. I also had jet lag, so that's made it a lot easier to get up early in the morning right now. But, you know, I was at the gym today for, you know, an hour getting my workout in, and it makes a big difference in the rest of my day. Diet, you know, trying to eat as healthy as I possibly can. And then, of course, you know, you have at least one day of the week where you cheat. And then just trying to understand how you can optimize your health from a longevity perspective. Because I'm firmly of the belief that I would rather, you know, be as healthy as I can for as long as possible. And then if you know, if it happens, just drop dead, as opposed to get sick and slowly, you know,
suffer for a long
time. Fall apart piece by piece. Yes. So if I can optimize my health, that sort of keeps me healthy longer. And then you just, you know, the machine just says, I'm done. I would prefer that. So I'm trying to understand these different things by looking different at different people that are working in the space, understanding what they're doing from a optimization or longevity perspective. And, you know, if it makes sense, see if I can implement things in my life in a practical way. Like, not, some people do some crazy things, so, you know, I'm not going down that road, but just, you know, if there's a way to, you know, okay, magnesium is a great example. Like, can you incorporate some simple element like that where you can take it in the morning or take it at night, and it helps you sleep and it helps you stay loose and has other cognitive benefits? But this is all based on reading the science and understanding how these things work, and then is it practical to implement? But the, you know, to answer your question, yes, I'm super big on this.
Yes, I think there is so much pseudoscience in this sphere. So people not being specialists giving out health advice, you should be really careful and really go through the science of health. And even with like magnesium or any other supplements that you're taking, sometimes people just like don't look into science enough. They just follow pseudoscientific advice.
Oh, I mean, you know, I'm on social media and it really is amazing to me. You know, people assume that there's like this magic pill that's going to fix everything, which is just not possible. And so, but nobody's willing to work, to actually read and understand what's really happening so that they can then see how it works. I mean, if you're in the biotech space, you do need to understand, like, you need to understand how the drug works. What is it going to do? How's it going to make this effect? How are you going to get it into the person? There's so many nuances that you need to understand. You know, when somebody tells you that they're going to sell you snake oil, you have to question it, because the chances of it working are probably zero, or having a therapeutic effect, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the placebo effect would be. If you want to believe it works, I guess it works. But to have a true therapeutic effect, you need to go through things rigorously to understand.
To be honest, I believe that most of the supplements out there on the market do not have enough scientific evidence backing up their therapeutic effects. It's just good marketing.
Oh, it's an extremely lucrative space. I mean, there's only a handful of supplement companies that actually produce at, you know, pharmaceutical grade GMP and so on and so forth. Most of them produce, but you may not be getting in that supplement everything that you thought you should be getting.
Well, this wraps up today's episode of The Startup Way. Thank you, Harry, for the profound insights and unique perspective you shared with us today. It's guests like you who make our podcast special and fill the episodes with such enriching conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to all our listeners, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast not to miss out on the new episodes. Until next time.